with Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Low Tide. Brought to you by The Pint, Oodle Noodle, and OilersNation.com.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
Good afternoon, everyone. Every Saturday, I get up and I go, okay, this is the day I drive in to wherever I'm going, and it's going to be beautiful and sunny, and there'll be no snow. So that hasn't happened, and it's like December in Minsk, but it's great time to talk about hockey, and it is definitely hockey weather here in Edmonton. You can email us at nationradio@team1260.com. We are Nation Radio, live at the Pint on this coming Saturday, not today, but coming up on Saturday. We have a very special announcement when we're there live with regard to the draft. Day two of the draft. So stay tuned for that 1 week from now. Our focus on Nation Radio is Oilers past, present, and future, plus the NHL's biggest story every week. And this week we have Kirk Ludeke from Bruins Draft Watch. He's our Eastern Seaboard draft expert, and we'll talk about some American kids at the under 18s going on right now. The USA teenagers at the top of the draft and a few sleepers from that part of hockey country as well. Also, Craig Button from NHL.com, NHL on the Fly, TSN, and other locales. We'll discuss his recent mock draft on TSN, which is getting a lot of play on the internet, the Central Scouting Bureau and his association and family association with CSB, and to get an idea about the playoffs so far, he had some interesting comments on NHL on the Fly last night. Guy Flaming, you just heard him on the Pipeline Show. He'll be back later on this hour. He attended the recent Frozen Four. We'll discuss that fascinating event, some NCAA kids who are rising and falling in the draft, and get an idea about what he's looking forward to this year at the NHL Draft 2011 in Minnesota. Next hour, it'll be Matt Bug from McKean's and Dauber Hockey. We'll talk about the draft tightening up at the top end and some depth players to keep in mind. Matt is we've had him on a few times. He's a local guy, but he writes for a couple of magazines, and he's got a really good insight into some of these key players we'll be looking at over the next few weeks. Cassie McClellan from RawCharge.com. We'll talk about the wisdom behind selecting Hedman and Kane before Kane by the Tampa Bay Lightning, and ask if taking a defenseman that high a couple of years ago looks good a couple of years later. Tim Correll from BlackhawkUp.com, making life miserable for Canucks fans, so we like him and we'll give him plenty of time later in the second hour. And Greg Grinnan from Taking Note, the best source for WHL news and lots of news, or at least there's a lot of rumors going on right now in the Western Hockey League about, not such a rumor about Chilliwack going to the island, but Regina Pats are a big rumor today. So that's pretty crazy. And we'll talk about that with Greg between 1:45 and 2 o'clock this afternoon. So just a couple minutes after 12, once again, as I mentioned, you can email us at nationradio@team1260.com. Lots of questions today, and we'll begin our conversation about the draft with a gentleman from Bruins Draft Watch. Good afternoon to Kirk Ludeke.
Hey, how's it going, Alan? Thanks for having me on.
Hey, you know what? You've been very busy this week. We've been staring at the top of the 2011 entry draft long enough to go a little bit cross-eyed. NHL teams sometimes do the same thing. At this point, do you think that Larson is still number one, or has Nugent Hopkins done enough to pass him?
Well, I told you, I think it was a month ago I was on, and I thought, yeah, Larson would be the guy, but I've been talking to NHL sources, and the kind of run that Nugent Hopkins put on at the end of the season really made a big statement. Now, unfortunately for him, he hasn't had much space in the series against Medicine Hat. And I was listening to the Pipeline Show, and they were talking about how the Tigers were putting two guys on him. And I think that's one thing about Nugent Hopkins that I've kind of heard from different people, and that's that, you know, if you take away his time and space, you're going to reduce his effectiveness. And let's face it, I mean, that's true for just about any hockey player. So, but I just think that given where he's playing and the kind of season he's had and his upside, I think I like Adam Larson, obviously, but he's not the dynamic kind of player that Nugent Hopkins is. Nugent Hopkins is just dynamic. The Nuge is a game breaker. And I think at the end of the day, he'll probably go number one.
If he is the number one offensive player in the draft, and I think he is, how close is a guy like Huberdeau and then Couturier? How far back are they from your opinion of Nugent Hopkins offensively?
Well, I think Huberdeau is just tremendous in what he's done in the playoffs. I've tweeted a couple times that what he's doing is just filthy, and I've watched a couple of his goals, and they're not just goals and assists he's getting, but they're crucial game-winning tallies and overtime, and their game-winning setups, you know, late in games, and you can't say enough about a player that manages to have that kind of impact at crunch time. And the thing with Huberdeau that I like so much is that the Sea Dogs are expected to win. I mean, they are a favorite. They're a heavy favorite. They were the best team in the CHL. And so now he's making a statement in the postseason. They had a little tougher time getting past Hanzik and Victoriaville, but they did it. And so they've moved on, and he's been integral element of their offense. So I really like Huberto. Now, I don't think he's seen in the class of Nugent Hopkins, to be honest with you, but I certainly see Huberto as a potential top five. As for Couturier, well, as you know, he's been dropping a bit, but you've got the New Jersey Devils picking at four, and I think he would be the kind of guy that would fit well with them if they don't opt for some skill on the blue line. So it's hard to say, but I think right now, if you have to go by trends, Huberto is definitely trending ahead of Couturier.
And let's just briefly talk about the defenseman before we move on from the draft or from the top end of the draft. Dougie Hamilton is playing well. Number one, is there a chance he would pass Larson by the time draft day rolls around? And if he doesn't, has he established himself clearly as the second best draft pick available on the blue line?
Yeah, I think my answer to that question would be no and yes. Yeah, I don't think Hamilton, as much as I, if you've read my blog, you know that I'm a big Dougie Hamilton guy. He's a great kid. I've had the pleasure of talking to him, seen him play. You know, he's just, he has the size and the tools to be a player in this game. I know some are a little concerned about his defensive awareness, but you have to look at the production he put up, 58 points in the regular season, now 14 points in the playoffs. So he's definitely proving that he's got that offensive dimension. But what you have to remember about Adam Larson is he's playing against men, and he's been doing it for longer than Hamilton has. So I think that while one could argue that perhaps Hamilton's upside could possibly be a little higher than Larson's, and still that would be a tough argument to make. I mean, you could argue it. I think at the end of the day, Larson has been on the radar scope longer. Scouts are a little more comfortable because he's done it longer, and his developmental curve isn't so as sudden as Hamilton's. And I think that's the difference between Hamilton and Larson and why Larson will go higher.
Let's change gears just a little bit. I know you've been blogging a lot on your site, BruinsDraftWatch.com. World Under 18, the USA team. Let's talk about a few of those guys who are making an impact, beginning with Rocco Grimaldi.
Yeah, I mean, he's a lot of fun to watch, and he plays with such passion and drive and determination, and he's a spiritual young man, and he's when you talk about a small player, you know, needing certain elite level hockey skills to have a chance, you know, he has that. If there's one thing that I get a little concerned about watching him, and I've seen it in both of the games there against Switzerland and against Slovakia yesterday, when he's got the puck and he's flying down the wing, he has a tendency to go wide and take it to the outside or crawl back to the outside. We'd like to see him, you know, go in and take it into traffic, into the prime scoring areas a little more, because he does have the wheels and the hands and the ability to stick handle in a phone booth to do it. But that's been kind of what I've been hearing and talking to scouts about when they get a little concerned about his game, is that because he is so small, he does have a tendency to move to the outside. And at this level, it's fine, but as he progresses up the ladder, gets to the NCAA, and I think in the NCAA, he'll continue to tear it up. But once you start talking pro hockey, once you start getting out on the perimeter, it's so much harder to have an impact and score goals against pro-caliber goaltenders and defenses, because they close up those passing lanes so quickly, your window of opportunity decreases, and I don't care how good a shooter you are, it's much tougher to get it into the net from the outside than if you're in close between the hash marks at the tops of the circles where the goaltender's reaction time's reduced.
If we saw him for the first time, would we compare him to Gerby or Ennis? Is he that type of dynamic player?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no question. Those are legitimate comparables to Rocco. And then again, I mean, I think he's tremendous, and he's a character player. He wants to be a player. And I go back to that old adage, the scouting adage that says, if you want to be a player badly enough, you're probably going to get there. And I think, that certainly Rocco Grimaldi doesn't have, any strikes against him in that regard. It's just that, when teams are deciding whether to spend a first round pick on him, they're going to look at the fact that he's kind of curling away and staying away from the traffic at times, and they're going to say, well, you know, how's that going to translate, you know, at the next level? And, you know, any player who's about, he's listed at 5'6", 160, I suspect he's smaller than that, but any player that is small is going to carry some inherent risk. So all those are all kinds of factors that the teams will weigh when they're putting together their boards and having those discussions at the combine and in the final hours before the 2011 draft.
In looking at Connor Murphy on your blog, one of the things that I always look for is a defenseman who has a nice range of skills. He brings some offense, but he's got a defensive side to him as well, right?
He does, yeah. The hard thing with Murphy is that he's missed so much time. He had a spleen injury last year, which really limited his action on the under-17 team, and then he had a back injury this year. Came into the Five Nations tournament, played one game or two games, I believe. Not very much, but was good, but he was rusty. He was, you know, you could see those raw projectables, but the guys that were at the tournament that I spoke to said, yeah, you know, his timing was off. This is a huge tournament. This is a make-or-break tournament for him because this is, all, you know, the who's who of NHL scouts are there watching him. And based on what I've seen from him in the first two games, he is raising his stock. I made a comment yesterday. It's always nice when your best offensive defenseman is also your best defensive defenseman, and that was Murphy yesterday. Well, I guess you could make an argument for Robbie Rousseau, and he played well, but Murphy's up there in terms of his ability to move the puck, good hard shot from the point, pretty good mobility. He's not as physical as you'd like him to be at his size, but he understands body leverage and takes good angles and is strong positionally, and he makes good decisions, you know, whether to stay home, when to jump up, and on the power play, he's been very, very effective on that point with Jacob Trouba. So, I mean, you look at that, the USA scored 5 power play goals yesterday. I mean, that a lot of that started on the blue line with the puck movement that Trouba and Murphy and then, of course, Rousseau and Seth Jones were doing. So they've got some real horses on the blue line for them.
Where do you project or where do you think Murphy might go in the draft? Second round or?
Yeah, he's looking. Yeah, I think he's a solid second rounder. Might sneak into the late first, depending on how well he plays. I mean, because it's one thing to do it against Switzerland and Slovakia, and now you got to see what he does against Russia, and then, you know, when the USA, you know, assuming they advance and get into these medal games here next week. I mean, that's really what people will be interested in seeing. But if he goes out and performs the way he has, he's got a shot to come in maybe late first because he's kind of like Derek Forbert last year in terms of that. You look for that upside, and he's got the size you can't teach. He's got the NHL bloodlines. Dad is Gordon Murphy, you know, current assistant coach for the Panthers and longtime NHL defenseman. And so it's pretty good situation, I think, for him. He's got the opportunity to be successful in the draft, but he's going to have to make some money here this week and really play well. But the biggest knock on him, like I said, was the missed time and the teams have to decide, is he injury prone or was it just bad luck? I mean, a spleen injury, that's probably bad luck. The back injury, that's something they're gonna have to look at and make sure it's not gonna be a chronic kind of thing where he's on the shelf more than he's on the ice.
This is Nation Radio on Team 1260 Edmonton Sports Radio, and we're in conversation with Kirk Ludicky from Bruins Draft Watch. One more on this USA team, and then we'll move on to some other questions. The goalie, John Gibson, as an Oiler observer over many decades, the Oilers seem to be doing a little bit better job of drafting goaltenders over the last, say, 4 or 5 years, or maybe even 6 years. This guy is somebody who is turning some heads and has a chance to be the first goaltender taken this year.
Yeah, I definitely think he's the front runner, honestly. I mean, he's a lot like Jack Campbell in terms, you know, the Jack Campbell International Team USA goalie, not the Jack Campbell Windsor Spitfires goalie. That's a story for another day, I suppose. But
that was well put.
No, he's very similar. Very good size, athleticism, but the composure. You know, you can't coach, no matter how much you work with a goaltender, you can't coach him to have ice water in his veins and to understand the moment and to maintain his calm and his poise and his focus, his concentration. And that's what I've seen from Gibson, especially in yesterday's game. You know, he was actually pulled out. They let McNeely play the third period because Gibson was so dialed in and dominant. I mean, he was swallowing up pucks, directing rebounds or not giving up rebounds, and he made it look easy. I mean, it was, granted, Slovakia didn't have the horses up front, but still, Gibson just has those measurables and immeasurables that NHL teams love. Now, the problem with Gibson is that I think you're going to see a trend this year where NHL teams are saying, well, you know what, do we really need to take NHL, you know, or we need to take goalies in the first round? I mean, there's such an emphasis on skill players up front and on defense that I think you could see Gibson, you know, fall into the second round, even though maybe a year ago, 2 years ago, he'd be a solid first-round player. But with some of the struggles, I mean, you see Campbell struggle in the OHL. You've seen Chet Pickard as kind of struggling in the Nashville system there. And, you know, those are two solid, you know, pretty high first-round picks. And so I think you're going to see teams say, well, you know, we can wait a little bit. And so Gibson may not go as high as you think he would, but I do think he'll be the first guy off the board, and he's got some very nice long-term potential, and he's going to Michigan. So,
Kirk, one of the best things about your Bruins Draft Watch blog for me is that not only do you cover the higher and the top level of the draft, but you go deep, and especially in a part of the world that we don't get a lot of information out of. Can you tell me about some of the kids outside the top end from the Eastern Seaboard that we as fans should be checking out?
Yeah, one guy I think was highly underrated on the central list is a kid named Jim Vesey. Jimmy Vesey, his dad is Jim Vesey, was a scoring legend at Merrimack College. Played with Jim Hrivnak, the former NHL goalie at Merrimack back in the mid '80s, and went on to be quite a prolific scorer in the IHL for St. Louis's farm team, Peoria Rivermen. Played a few games, but unfortunately he was behind a couple of guys you may have heard of, Brett Hull and Paul McLean on the right wing there in St. Louis. And so Jim Sr. wasn't a great skater. His son Jimmy is a better skater, has the same kind of hockey sense and good hands, good size, about 6'1", 6'2". He's going to get bigger and fill out. And I just think he played for Belmont Hill this year, and he was really one of their key offensive players, and he's got a lot of potential. He's a long term project. Obviously, playing at that level of competition, it's harder to project where these guys are going to look like as NHL players. But the skating is better than some people are led to believe. It he has shown an improvement. Needs to get a little quicker. His first few steps are only fair, but he's very elusive. And just again, that the key thing that jumps out to me when I watch him is his anticipation. And the way he just kind of knows, has a knack for being in the right place at the right time. The puck follows him around the ice, and he's headed to Harvard, but he's going to have to figure out where he's going to play next year, and I suspect he's going to be in the USHL or some junior league. I do not believe he's going to return to prep, because I believe he and his dad both recognize that that's just not the best system for his development right now.
So he's kind of a draft and follow, a late rounder who may develop, and you'll know probably 4 or 5 years down the line.
Correct, yeah.
Okay. All right. Your blog this week mentioned somebody that I've sort of had an interest in and been following a little bit, Joel Edmondson out of the WHL. What have you heard about him?
Well, he's a little behind the development curve, because he's only in his, you know, he's a draft eligible, but he didn't make the WHL last year. He's only in his first full season. So whereas most guys come in and they have 2 years in the WHL or the, you know, Quebec League or the Ontario League and then get drafted, it's a little more rare when the guys have just the 1 year of development. So he's a little behind in terms of his experience and understanding, you know, certain situations, reads and things like that. But with his size, and he plays, you know, he's pretty fairly mobile from what I understand. I mean, I've only seen video of him, but, you know, he's not a great skater, but he's not bad. And with some work, and as he gets stronger and his lower leg drive, he'll improve and be more a powerful skater. And then he's got some bite, got some snarl. So teams always like that, because if nothing else, if the offensive element never really develops in the game, you've got a guy who's a shutdown, mean, nasty son of a gun in your face kind of guy, crease clearer. And so that's what I've been hearing on him. One player that was interesting, that was a similar situation in terms of only having 1 year of major junior before he got drafted, was the Bruins' Patrice Bergeron. Most people don't realize that he was playing midget AAA for a team in Quebec, and then he went to the Bathurst Titan, and then the Bruins drafted him, and then he made the NHL right out of his first camp. So Patrice Bergeron went from midget AAA to major junior to the NHL in a span of 3 years. So those guys are out there. They're very rare to see a prospect develop that quickly and go to the NHL, but Edmondson is on a similar kind of track.
I don't know much about the, and this is a change in question here, but I don't know much about Boston's water except what the Standells talk about in dirty water. What's going on with Chara? He was in the hospital last night.
Yeah, I mean, that was kind of took everyone by surprise, certainly, and that was a big, you know, buzz. Twitter was all a buzz this morning about it, but apparently he's probably if it's left in his hands, he's going to play, but the Bruins are obviously going to consult their medical staff and he'll be evaluated. But I mean, he's a warrior. That's the kind of guy he is. And I think, you know, he'll be out there, but they'll certainly have to keep an eye on it, and, you know, maybe limit his ice time. And it's an interesting situation how that might affect Claude Julien's strategy, because he's used to leaning on him for 20, you know, upwards of 27 minutes a game.
Yeah, and it's going to be
in the playoffs. So
yeah, it's going
to
be
the rest of the defense are going to have to step up, I think.
Yeah, and it's a game they have to win tonight. Kirk, thanks so much. We appreciate it, and we'll have you back again.
It's been my pleasure. Always enjoy coming on. Take care.
That's Kirk Ludeke from Bruins Draft Watch. If you've never been on his blog, the exact address is Bruins2011draftwatch.blogspot.com. It's outstanding. One of the best sources of the 2011 draft you can find on the internet. This is Nation Radio. We're back with Craig Button after this.
This is Nation Radio with Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Low Tide. Brought to you by The Pint, Oodle Noodle, and OilersNation.com.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
It's 12:26 on Nation Radio. I think it's 4-0 now for Detroit over Phoenix. It's no fun to be a Phoenix Coyote right now, and that's unlikely to change when they get back to Phoenix. This is Nation Radio. We're doing a very special draft edition. There was lots happening. The lottery happened this week. New Jersey won, but the Oilers really won because they'll be picking first overall. Finalist for Central Scouting Bureau, which, you know, it got me thinking. I had a big case of deja vu this week. I remember going downtown in Maidstone, Saskatchewan, and going to the Rexall drugstore in July of 75 and reading about the beginning of Central Scouting and the hiring of Jack Button as the first chief scout or director of Central Scouting. And I thought it was a good idea because I was a Bruins fan and a California Golden Seals fan, and the Bruins could draft and the Seals couldn't. So I think that they did a lot of good over the years. And we welcome as our next guest, Mr. Craig Button from NHL on the Fly, NHL Network, ESPN, NHL.com, TSN. Did I miss anything there, Craig?
Not currently, Alan.
you're doing pretty well. You've done pretty well in this media business there, buddy.
Well, you know, I think it's a, you know, with all the content that's out there now, and I think all the interest, we see so much interest from fans, and I think it's a lot of fun to try to, I mean, there's one thing to have different opinions, but I think everybody brings a different perspective, and that creates debate, and that's all good. So I'm glad to be part of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And just a quick question on the Central Scouting and your dad. He moved to Montreal. You would have been probably a teenager at that time. Do you remember that whole process?
I do. I was 11. And, you know, but my mother's from Toronto. So, I mean, we had spent so much time in Canada at various times that it wasn't like it was moving to a different place. It was a place that we were comfortable with. I'd seen junior hockey games in the Quebec League with my dad when I was younger. So moving there was actually a lot of fun because you knew about the Montreal Canadiens and the Toronto Maple Leafs, and it certainly turned out to be just a wonderful place to grow up.
Would you agree with my earlier statement that Central Scouting really did help those bottom feeder teams like the Seals in aiding them in drafting?
Yeah. There was a couple of things that had happened. The WHA was really aggressively pursuing the top players, and I think the NHL recognized that they needed some help, because economically, it wasn't just the bottom teams, but economically teams didn't have the resources to put into scouting to find these players. So it not only helped them become competitive, but it also helped them on an economic point of view as well. And I think that is still the case for certain teams, to just have information and understand where you want to spend your scouting dollars.
Now let's get to the mock draft that you did for TSN, and it's caused a lot of debate on the internet. And I think one of the things that it did was it gave an idea about how much fluidity there is in this year's draft at the top end. You could have any number of players chosen in the top 10, correct?
Yeah, and then let me make this qualifier. I am not trying to predict where players will go. That is a reflection. I mean, we're the teams where we did it following the lottery, but that is a reflection of how I've ranked the players.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not so much saying this player will go there, but when you see that list of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then the corresponding team that just happens to be, that's where they would fall if they took that player. That is actually my rating right today of the players eligible for the draft.
Okay. Let's start with number one and the Oilers. I think a month ago it would have been Adam Larson, but Nugent Hopkins has done so much to move up, and he really is a unique and a brilliant offensive player.
I think he just hit the word. It's unique. I don't know where you find those players, Alan. You can't trade for them. They don't show up in free agency. So if you don't draft them, I don't know how you're going to get them. And a player like Ryan Nugent-Hopkins, to me, he controls the game with the puck. Pavel Datsyuk has 3 points today. You're talking about Detroit Phoenix.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, think about what Pavel Datsyuk means to a team. Think about Henrik Zetterberg. I've compared Nugent-Hopkins in terms of style and stature to a Joe Sakic. And I don't know where you find those guys. So when you already have Taylor Hall, and that guy is dynamic, I think that it's kind of like how Trottier made Bossy a 50-goal scorer. Mike Bossy was a terrific goal scorer, but Trottier, what he brought to the game, really complimented Bossy. I see exactly the same thing in Nugent Hopkins. And let me just go one step further for the Edmonton Oilers to get a little bit more specific from my point of view. Ryan Whitney was playing at a level of the top defenseman in the league. Tom Gilbert, Theo Pekham, Ladislav Smith, Jeff Petrie, who's in the minors. I think they have the makings of being a pretty good defense, and I don't think Adam Larson is in the same category of player as Ryan Nugent Hopkins. And I think a player like that, a number one, a true number one center that can create plays and create offense and make other players around him better, those guys don't grow on trees.
The next pick that you had, number two, I was fascinated by because it's exactly what happened a year ago with the Taylor versus Tyler. Sagan came on late like Huberdeau is doing and really had an impact. And by the time the draft came, it was basically 50-50 on the draft floor.
Well, Jonathan Huberdeau, if you get a chance to watch him play, and there's a very good chance that St. John will be in the Memorial Cup. But when you watch Jonathan Huberdeau, what you really have to do is really – and I think this is a big part of scouting, Alan. You watch a player at the beginning and you say, you watch a player at the beginning of the season and you go, okay, here's the attributes they have. Then, now you're looking for progression, because the big part of scouting is projecting. And there's certain players that are more physically mature at 17, 18 than other players. And you're watching for not only the maturity physically, but the maturity in their game. And I think that when you watch Jonathan Huberdeau, all you're seeing is the progression of a player. He's got the skills. He's met the challenges. He is now, you see a confident player on the ice that's able to do so many different things in the game from a skill point, from a competitive point of view. And I think now when you look at it and say, wow, this guy, once he gets a little bit bigger and stronger, he could really have an impact on the game. And that's why a lot of times you have to take it over the course of a period of, not over a course of a year, but over a period of time and see who's moving ahead and who's falling behind, because certain players have a lot more room to improve than others.
Is that what happened with you were the scouting director with Dallas when the year that they took Ginla, correct?
Yes.
Did he improve a lot but from the beginning of the year through to draft day?
Yeah, no question he did. You know, there's one caveat I want to add to the whole Ginla situation. That was the lockout. That was the first lockout in 1994. And a lot of teams cut back on their scouting. And I think that when the lockout ended, a lot of teams ended up trying to pick up where they hadn't done work in the first part of the year. So we that didn't happen to us in Dallas. So we had the luxury of watching all the players over a longer period of time. And I don't think that a lot of other teams had that luxury because they weren't scouting. So,
right.
You know, that's the caveat, but no question about it. I mean, I'll tell you when we really first started to notice Jerome Iginla was the previous year in the Memorial Cup, when Kamloops had that really good Memorial Cup team with Nolan Baumgartner and that group of players. And that's, I mean, he was just starting to watch and go, wow, this guy could be a really good player. So we were able to follow it up from that point of view. But certainly, I mean, Joel McGill was rated 26th by NHL Central Scouting. I mean, think about it.
that was a good day.
It was. I mean, it was a really good day. And I think Shane Doan was in that draft, and Brian Berard and Wade Redden. I mean, there were some really good players in that draft. And but you know, certainly getting an impact player like that at 11, I mean, you're not counting on that.
No, absolutely. Steve Kelly was in that draft too. Gabriel Landeskog.
I didn't want to remind Oilers fans of that.
Oh, I did it. It's okay. Gabriel Landeskog is a physical guy, and I got to tell you, on the TSN coverage the other night, I was amazed, and you just get a little soundbite, not much, but we had a report that he was a very mature kid and very well-spoken. He really is a grown-up at age 18.
Yes, and I think, one of the things that, when you watch some of these guys, and having seen Mike Modano and Trevor Linden in the same draft, Trevor Linden, you hear the term mature beyond his years. That was what Trevor Linden was. And, you know, it wasn't that Mike Modano wasn't going to mature, but he just wasn't as mature as Trevor at that age. And I think you see a lot of that with Gabriel Landeskog. And, you know, you got to think that, you know, when you look at him and you look at the fact that here's a young man who left Sweden to come over to Canada, I mean, that in itself speaks to the maturity and the confidence of the young man. And he is impressive as a person, and he's a good, good, solid player that if you talk about guys that might be NHL ready come September, October of 2011, I mean, he might be the guy that's closest to NHL ready.
I wanted to take a minute here or a couple of minutes to talk about how I find it fascinating how you've ranked the defensemen. You've got Ryan Murphy at 4, Adam Larson at 6, and then you go down to Nathan Beaulieu and Jamie Oleksiak. And can you get, in 100 words or less, tell me why Larson is slipping, or at least why you have him below an offensive player like Murphy? And then later on, you've got Dougie Hamilton as well. So tell me why it's spaced out like that, because it's a fascinating part of your mock draft.
Okay. Well, here's what I think, and I'll try to be real brief here. I see Ryan Murphy as a Dan Boyle type player. I see him as a guy that can play any situation in the game, can dictate offensively, can join the attack, and play those big minutes. I see Adam Larson more as a type of a Sammy Salo type player, minus the injuries.
Right. Okay.
But that the big shot from the point, the big rangy guy. He's not going to be a physical force. He's going to be making the plays up the ice with real good puck playing. And Sammy Salo has been a real good player in the NHL. And I think Adam Larson, probably a better Sammy Salo. So I look at it as a guy like Ryan Murphy, and we saw what Ryan Ellis, Nashville's first round pick, did for Windsor, winning Memorial Cup. I see Ryan Murphy in much the similar light. A guy that can, he's not 6'4", but in every other area of the game, Ryan Murphy to me is a dominant. He's a dominant thinker. He's got great hands. He's quick. He's never overwhelmed physically. You always go, oh, how are they going to handle the physical grind? I remember thinking about Scott Niedermeyer. Scott Niedermeyer, you'd come down on him and you think you had a physical advantage, and all of a sudden he had the puck and he was going the other way, and you're going, what happened here?
Yeah.
and that's the smarts, and I think that's what it is. I've described Adam Larson. Nathan Beaulieu, to me, he's one of those real good, complete players. I don't know if he's going to be as rugged as a Brad Stewart, that physical, but I see him in kind of the same light. He's going to be able to add some offense. He's going to be able to play some important minutes in the game, penalty killing, and really handle a lot of play. Is he going to be a great offensive player? Probably not. Dougie Hamilton, a little bit down. I just don't have him rated as high as other people do, and that doesn't mean he's not going to play in the NHL. I think he's a great competitor. I think that he's got a chance to be a good, solid NHL player. But I see him as a second pair, big, strong, defending type defenseman. And I just think the other guys, I do talk about Oleksiak, the big kid from Northeastern, a 6'7" player that can play like him. I think he's unique as well on the other side, because he's big, he's rangy, he's physical, he's got good puck skills. And at 6'7", a guy that wants to initiate and get in there, I think that, again, I use the word unique.
A few questions have been emailed while we've been talking, so I'm going to ask you two here and then let you go. This is from Speeds. He talks about Couturier. What are scouts seeing or thinking they're seeing that suggests a player who is struggling or not improving, or whatever you want to call it? Is it speed? Is it what exactly has seen Couturier drop?
Well, I think it's two things. Number one, it's not so much that Sean's dropped. It's just when you start at such a high plateau and a high level, it's other players like, you know, Jonathan Huberdeau really saying, okay, you watch Huberdeau and you go, wow, he's not bad. Ryan Strome. And you say, wow. It's just the fact that those guys have really shown that potential. And I don't think that Sean Couturier is going to be, a real good two-way player in the National Hockey League. The reason he's at seven for me is that I don't see him as dynamic as Strome or as Huberdeau or as Hopkins or those guys. He'll play and he'll contribute to a team because he's a good, smart, two-way player. He's competitive, but those dynamic qualities that you're looking for, I don't think he matches up with those other guys in front of him.
And one final question, and this is a kind of a combination of your scouting director and your GM hats. You have to put both of them on. If you're on the floor and you're the general manager and your chief scout says to you, look, we're at number 19 with the Los Angeles Kings pick, as an example, and we have a chance to get up to number 11, and there's a guy there, and he's absolutely sure he's the guy. Do you move heaven and earth to make that trade, even if it means maybe robbing next year's draft or possibly part of your future in another area?
Well, I think when you have a scouting staff that's confident to make those stands and to initiate, hey, we want this player or that player, I think as a general manager, you have to listen and you have to try to do everything you can to move up. I mean, you trust them. I believe as a general manager, you have to get out of the way of the scouts. You give them direction, tell them what you're looking for, and then get out of their way, let them make the picks. But then when they tell you that, you got to listen. And I think if you looked at it and you said, okay, we're going to trade something in the future, you're always trying to balance out today with the future. And I don't think that you go blind and you just be reckless about it. But if it comes down to a situation where you really feel this player is, and this is part of assessing in the future too, you might say, hey, listen, the guy we get here at 11 is so much better than the guy we get at 19, and perhaps flip-flop in picks in the 2012 draft. Listen, it's not a great deep draft, and we think we'll pick 12, and there's not a player as good as this. It's all kind of moving parts, and it's symbiotic. So you have to look at it, and that's where you have to encourage your scouts, hey, listen, no today, no tomorrow, so that we can make the absolute best move with the information we have going into the draft right now.
Craig, this was an education. Thanks so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you, Alan. Have a good day.
You too. Craig Button, man, I enjoyed that very much. If you want to check out his mock draft, it's on TSN. It's version 1.0, and it was posted on the 13th of April. And you can see Craig Button on NHL on the Fly, NHL Network, ESPN, NHL.com, TSN. He's pretty much everywhere. And I found that very interesting. Some really good insight there from Mr. Button. Coming up in the next 10 minutes or so, we're going to be talking to Guy Flaming from Pipeline Show, a little bit about his experience at the Frozen Four, and then Matt Bug, who has some insight on the draft as well.
This is Nation Radio with Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Low Tide. Brought to you by The Pint, Oodle Noodle, and OilersNation.com.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
It's 12:47, late in the second period now. It's Detroit 4 and Phoenix 1. Email here from Willie1958. Does it bother Ludicky Button Flaming that Medicine Hat is shutting down Nugent Hopkins with such apparent ease? Seem to recall that Windsor's handling of Seguin was part of the reason he dropped to number 2, and yet that was an absolutely exceptional Windsor team, and I'd understood that Medicine Hat was good but not exceptional. Is that a red flag for drafting Ryan Nugent Hopkins number 1? Well, we just happened to have Guy Flaming on the phone, so let's ask him. Is that a red flag, the fact that Medicine Hat has been able to shut him down rather easily, or at least so far in the series?
I wouldn't say it's a red flag. I would say it's a great example of a team stepping up to the challenge of handling, trying to shut down a player of Ryan Nugent Hopkins and his talent level. It takes a team effort, and we're told that they're sticking a couple guys on him. That would be tough for any kind of a player. I mean, listen, Wayne Gretzky was shadowed back in the day. There's talented players like that have to deal with that, and the fact that so far he hasn't been able to crack the score sheet in the second round may be a bit of a concern, but when you take everything into account, I think it's understandable with the way Medicine Hat is playing right now.
Is Nugent Hopkins the most talented offensive player you've seen in the WHL draft eligible year?
Yep, that I've seen this year, no question. He's deadly every time he's on the ice, and in the games that we saw, you know, against the Oil Kings, I saw him play in Red Deer against Vancouver a couple times this year as well. And, yeah, he's a dangerous player, especially, you know, inside the circles from the hash marks or anywhere around, probably within 20 feet of the net, he can score from anywhere and shoots at will and started to do that more in the second half. I know that was a concern early on, is that he wasn't necessarily being selfish enough. Because he has such a good shot. We joked with him earlier in the year that the team might score more on his rebounds than they would on his passes just because he shoots the puck so well. But wasn't doing that early on in the season, was doing it more in the second half, and I think that really helped Red Deer down the stretch. They really got to get off the schneid here, though, against Medicine Hat. Tough task, but they got to find a way to get it done.
When you and Dean do your mock drafts, he usually kicks your ass so badly it's embarrassing. So if you get the first overall pick this year, are you going to take Nugent Hopkins? Is that where you have him?
We talked about it on Tuesday night, and right now, yeah, I do have Nugent Hopkins going number one, and he has Adam Larson going number one. But you've been talking to guys all for the last couple months, and I think the top three or four is pretty much wide open. But you can make an argument for several different players. And, you know, I think that everybody probably has the same four or five guys going in the top four or five, but, you know, you could ask five different people and have completely different orders. So I think it's interesting this year, and I think that's what's going to make draft day so fun, is that it's so unpredictable.
The thing that worries me about Larson, and really the only thing, and I know he's playing again amongst men and all that stuff, but if you end up drafting a really good defensive player and you do it in a year where you've passed on, you know, as an example with Tampa Bay, Duchesne and Evander Kane and some really, really prolific, outstanding offensive players, you know, 10 years down the line, it may not seem like you got good value for that first overall pick.
Well, that happens, but, you know, in a team, if we're speaking specifically about the Oilers, I mean, that's a huge concern for them right now is their depth on the blue line in terms of prospects coming up. They don't have a true bona fide number one guy, and Adam Larson can be that. So, you know, if the Oilers decide to take Nugent Hopkins, great, because that's a hole and a concern for them as well down the middle. And if they take the defenseman, great, because that's a problem for them too. So I honestly don't think they can go wrong taking either guy. You know, Gabriel Landeskog would be a surprise to me because they seem to have, you know, depth and you know, some guys there in that position on the left side with Hall and Pajarvi and other guys, Curtis Hamilton. So I don't think that's necessary, and you don't want to necessarily draft by need, but when you're picking number one, I think you can kind of draft by need, or at least filling organizational holes. So that would be a surprise. So, you know, for me, it's down the middle or on the back end.
For me, the Landeskog pick is, as you say, it's not necessarily the one that you would think. But if Pajarvi was, like, he's a big guy, but he doesn't play that rugged style. Do you think,
right,
not necessarily Landeskog, but do you think the Oilers will be looking for grit in the draft again this year?
Always. They always do. And, you know, I think they did a pretty good job of addressing that with some bodies last year. Yeah, I could still see that because in the long run, they still want to get bigger and stronger up front, and they have some guys, you know, bringing in Tubert through trade on the back end. They have guys like that in the system. Theo Peckham and Alex Blond can play physical as well. So maybe up front is where they still need to add some toughness. But I would think skill is probably their biggest need, and some size and some grit. If you can get, you know, a big guy with some size and some skill. Of course, those guys are few and far between, and they'll go in the first half of the first round. But even in the later stages, I think you're looking for size and skill.
Moose sent this along earlier on the Oilers Nation blog. He said, I'm going to ask you this, Guy. Would you trade number 1, 19, and 31 picks to Colorado for number 2 and 11 if you could be sure that they stayed away from your choice, your first choice? Would you do that?
Oh, well, I suppose that's worth considering, but you're giving up three picks. You're going to get the number one guy, and the number two guy is pretty much a sell-off, because especially if you're going to end up with the guy that you want anyway. So basically, you're trading 19 and 31 for the 11. Yeah, I suppose that's something worth considering. It certainly gets you up into that that area where that first drop-off or the second drop-off probably comes into play. But I think you can probably get a pretty good defenseman. If you take a forward with that first pick, you're taking a defenseman with the second one. I think you would agree with that.
Yeah, for sure.
I think that with that second pick where the LA Kings have right now in that 17 to 19 area, I think that's you can still get a good defenseman there. You know, somebody like Scott Mayfield, I think, would still be there. Oleksiak might still be around in that area. So I think there's defensemen available.
Okay, let's change gears a little bit. Aside from your bitching and moaning about how difficult the trip was on the way back, how did you enjoy the Frozen Four?
It was outstanding. Yeah, hey, listen, that was not a great travel day, but the Frozen Four was fantastic, really entertaining. I would highly recommend it to any hockey fan that has never taken the event in before. It has a completely different feel than the CHL experience up here. At the rinks, it's completely. And this was a national championship. It's not a regular season game in January, so I imagine you can't really compare it. It would be like playing or going to the Memorial Cup in an NHL building that is sold out with passionate fans that are live and die with those teams. That's what it would be like. And the Memorial Cup is played in junior hockey rinks. That's kind of the attraction for that tournament. So. Completely different feel to it, but really passionate fans. The North Dakota folks that showed up, even when their team wasn't in the final, most of them stuck around for the final, and they're loud and rambunctious. The Duluth crowd, obviously, because it was in their state, came out in full force. It was a great event. You have the marching bands playing, so you have that kind of college atmosphere to it, and the hockey was fantastic. And that rink in Minnesota, Alan, let me tell you, that is a fantastic facility. And if Darrell Cates is planning the new rink at all based on the XL Energy Center in Minnesota, Oiler fans will be ecstatic with the way it turns out.
Oh, that's outstanding. The thing that kind of, it doesn't bug me, but I've always felt like you work that hard, a one-off game, like a one-game wins all. Is there any sense ever that they would change the format?
No, I don't get that sense. I mean, they're student athletes, so their schedule isn't, they can't play, a seven-game series throughout the NCAA tournament. It's college sports. You see it in basketball. You see it in football. Well, you don't see a tournament structure in football, but it's even the same way in the CIS, right? When you get to the national tournament, they're all one games. There's no series. That's the way it is in college sports. And you would think that if North Dakota plays Michigan in a best of seven series, the Wolverines probably don't win that. But in a one game off, it's equal for both teams. Either team can pull it out in one game, and not, as Red Berenson said it, the best team doesn't always win.
If you took my age and added it to your age and divided it by four, we'd still be older than the kid the Sioux Greyhounds hired to be their new GM. Does this guy shave?
Oh, wow. It's funny because the OHL website right now has a picture of him at their press conference, and it looks like basically a player signing announcement. Like he's a baby-faced guy. He's 25 years old, and I'm sure that's a record for youngest GM in the CHL. But he looks like he could be 17 or 18. And, we had him on the show today, a really well-spoken guy, and not shy about, not ducking any questions about his age and how that's going to be, talked about for a long time. And we asked him point blank, what do you have to do to prove that your age isn't going to be a detriment? And he said, we got to win. So he definitely has the right mindset, the right attitude, and he has some background with the team. So obviously he's familiar with the organization. I believe he's from the Sioux. So outside of his age, it's a fit all the way around. It's just you don't see guys that young getting high-profile jobs like that.
He looks like the middle kid from the Brady Bunch in this picture.
Yeah.
Like he's a young guy.
Yeah, hey, really young.
How many interviews have you done with the draft-eligible, the guys who are going to be taken in the draft so far this year?
Well, we do at least one every show, so we must be, I think we went through the guys listed in the first round for Central, and I think we've checked off most of them by now. Probably must be at least 50 guys by now.
And where can people access them? Because people ask me that, believe it or not. They hear your show, and they go, where can I get that? Tell everybody where you can get them.
Well, each show is podcasted on the Team 1260 website. Now, I think that changes after every show, but we archive every interview from every show we've ever done on our website at thepipelineshow.com. We have a media archive button on our toolbar, and that'll take you to each of our six seasons so far that we've been on the air, and each season is broken down by show, and each show is broken down by segment. So every show for this past season is there, and every show there's at least one guy from the 2011 draft. And today's guy was Nick Shore of the Denver Pioneers.
All right, Guy, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
All right, Alan, have a good one.
All right, Guy Flaming from the Pipeline Show and Coming Down the Pipe blog. Want to check him out. And there's some great stuff, some really good interviews. And make sure you take advantage of that as we get closer to draft day. It's interesting to hear what these guys think. Coming up in the next hour, Matt Bug will talk to Cassie McLennan from the Raw Charge Tampa Bay Lightning blog, Tim Correll from Blackhawk Up blog, that's hard to say, and Greg Drennan from Taking Note. We'll talk a little bit about the WHL. It's all coming up next hour.
This is Nation Radio with Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Low Tide. Brought to you by The Pint, Oodle Noodle, and OilersNation.com.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
It's 4 minutes after 1 o'clock, and just before we talk to Mad Bug, got a email here from Speeds. Got to disagree with you and Flaming. Retaking one forward and one defenseman is the way to go this year. Personally, I'd like to see Evans take a forward at 1, at 19, and at 31, unless a defenseman they really like slips to 19 or 31. And maybe it's just the way it's worked out, but the Oilers have had 7 first or second round picks in the last 3 drafts. They've taken 6 forwards and Alex Plante. And Speeds goes to say, actually, I'm not entirely sure if you and Guy were saying the Oilers should draft a forward or an D, or that you just expect they will. Which was it? Well, for me, it's just a matter of tradition. The Oilers usually draft forward and then follow up with a defenseman. And I think we saw a really good insight into that in Oil Change when they were talking about taking Marinson at 31. They ended up with Pitlick because they thought he was the best player available. But there was a lot of dialogue. They'd already taken Taylor Hall at number one and eventually made a trade to pick up Marinson in round two. But it was a discussion, and I just think that's the tradition. The Oilers, I think, rightly view taking a forward at the top pick is the better idea, because usually that's when all the really good skill players are gone by, what, number 10 or 15 in any given draft year. And if you're asking me what I think is going to happen, I think it's already pretty much fait accompli. The Oilers will talk to the teams at 2 and 3 to see who they're taking. If it's someone other than Ryan Nugent-Hopkins, they may swing a deal, but Ryan Nugent-Hopkins will, I think it's like 90% he'll get drafted here, and then he'll play in Red Deer next year at the World Junior Championships in Calgary and Edmonton, and then they'll think about turning him pro the following year for lots of reasons. Number one, the Oilers have so many kids. They could go a year just playing these kids, and Hartikainen might be the only rookie in 11-12, and that would be okay too, because how many 2-, 3-, and 4-year players do they have that are under 23 years old? It's a very young group, and if they're going to bring in a center who can win faceoffs, another defenseman, and maybe a gritty winger, adding that threesome to what the Oilers already have, you probably already have a very busy lineup and a few people that you're going to have to send down, maybe like Colin Fraser, that you didn't plan on a year ago. So that's what I think. I think Nugent Hopkins is going to be number one. Now, in hour number two, we're going to be talking to Cassie McLennan from Rod Charge blog, also Tim Correll from Blackhawk Up blog, and Greg Drennan from Taking Note. But we're talking right now to Matt Bug, who writes for McKean's and Dauber Hockey. We've had him on before because he's an excellent guest talking about the draft and specifically the WHL. In your March mock draft on Dauber Hockey, Matt, you had the Oilers taking Adam Larson this month. You've changed it to Ryan Nugent-Hopkins. It's becoming more and more difficult to keep him. Do you agree with that?
Well, it's becoming more and more difficult to keep him out of top position despite his struggles in the postseason so far, because he's been doing it at a stage that's here. Our scouts have had a chance to get to know him better. They've had a chance to see him work his magic in the first round against the Oil Kings. And I think minus this second round, he's made a great impression. And meanwhile, Adam Larson, I think, had to do a lot in the Elitserien playoffs to make as much or a better impression. And I don't think he's done that. He's played well, but not that well.
Larson's offense is a little bit of a concern. He had a solid year in the Swedish Elite League in 09-10, playing a lot of power play minutes. But this year, offensively at least, he's been somewhat ordinary. Is that the word you're getting? Is that the reason he's just not getting enough power play time?
Well, a big part of the problem have been teammates Tim Erickson and David Rundblad. They've taken away a lot of that available time. And Larson is really a player that creates offense from his own zone. He's not a player like Rundblad who's going to rush up the ice and create offense that way. He's a very cerebral player. And while I don't think he's producing at the level that a lot of people would like in the Elitserien right now, I don't think he'll have a problem here being a 30, 40-point guy, but it's certainly been a barrier to GMs perhaps ranking him number one.
I look at the Tampa Bay draft where they went with Stamkos and the following year Hedman. Oilers last year went with Taylor Hall. Is Larson the type of player who could impact physically and somewhat offensively similar to Hedman, or is he a different player type?
He's a different type of player, although they both have that man size. Hedman, of course, is a little bigger at about 6'6". Larson's about 6'3 and 200 pounds right now. But Larson, just the same, is a player that can step in right away and make a difference. Maybe he's not going to do it on the score sheet so much, but he's got a man's body. He's been playing against men. He was averaging, 22 minutes a game in the playoffs for Skellefteå. And I think he's a guy that even if he's not scoring, he can still be useful.
However, if you're picking first overall, Nugent Hopkins is the more attractive option because of the offense, right?
He absolutely is, and that's sort of the thing that the Oilers will have to weigh. Do they want a guy who can come in and not have to work on himself as much physically but not contribute right away, or will they take a risk on a smaller player who has elite vision and skating ability but maybe doesn't have the body type to survive the grind right away?
Oilers chief scout Stu McGregor has shown a tendency since he became the chief scout to take the safe pick. I always thought that was Larson, but after seeing Nugent Hopkins and how well he played and how much he progressed after the World Junior Championships, maybe he's the safe pick now. Do you agree with that?
I think in some ways he is. You know the type of game you're going to get from him, and the only barrier to him translating his offense to the NHL is whether or not he can add a few pounds. You look at Patrick Kane, who I think is a great prototype for Nugent Hopkins, and Kane didn't have to do a whole lot. Mind you, he scored at a much greater rate in the OHL in his draft year. But this is a player who thrives on his intelligence, on his speed, on his hands, whereas Larson, he's going to have to figure things out here. So in a few respects, Nugent Hopkins is the safer pick.
Your top five is, according to your latest top five anyway, Ryan Nugent Hopkins, and you've got Larson at four. Your number two guy is Gabriel Landeskog. Tell us about him and why you have him number two.
Well, I don't think he has the offense to be a top-end player. Like Larson, he can step in right away and make an impact from minute one. He has so many intangibles that it's tough to drop him from the top five. Mind you, my mock draft, of course, is based on how teams may see the draft. In my own top five, he's down at number four, just because I think there are a couple other players, including Nugent Hopkins and Sean Couturier, who have the ability to contribute a bit more on offense in their career.
You mentioned Couturier, and do you still have him in your top five?
I have him number three. I don't think he's really swayed me at all this year either way. He didn't win a scoring title like I may have wanted to see him follow up with, but he produced at an elite level again against his peers, acquitted himself, I thought, very well at the World Juniors, and to top it off, has a great two-way game, and I think he's just a hair ahead of Landeskog in all those respects.
Okay, we've listed off four of your top five on your personal list: Nugent Hopkins, Landeskog, Couturier, and Larson. Who rounds out your top five on your personal list?
This will be a surprise to some people, but I have to put Dougie Hamilton there. He's been sublime all playoffs long for Niagara. I believe he has 11 points right now. He's just a really, really good player. He was a later conversion to defense. He was a forward as a teenager, and you can see that in the way that he's used as a screen on the power play sometimes. He's got great puck skills, and I don't know why this guy hasn't gotten more respect. He's outplaying Ryan Strome, I think, right now. And, of the three defensemen that I think could be the best from this class, Hamilton, Larson, and Ryan Murphy, Hamilton has all the tools that you want in a number one guy.
If this year had gone a lot longer, is Hamilton the sort of player who might have moved up and challenged Larson for the top defense choice?
Well, he still could. He has the ability to rack up some more points in the playoffs and hopefully survive this current round. But you're right, I think if the season were a bit longer, he would have certainly won out. It's very interesting because you don't usually see the European kid in, a supposedly faraway league take the early press. Usually it's a Canadian boy like Hamilton, but this year he's been really underrated, I think.
Mm-hmm. What do you make of Steve Tambellini saying the first overall pick is in play for trade? That didn't happen last year. It was a clearer draft at the top. Is this a matter of the Oilers maybe deciding on their number one pick and then seeing how far they can trade down and still get that guy?
I think so. There are, six different players that could conceivably go number one. If the Oilers feel that their player, perhaps Larson, will be available around the 4 or 5 spot, it wouldn't necessarily hurt them to trade down. We know that Florida is probably going to be looking at a forward. We know Colorado probably wants a winger, so there is that intelligence there that indicates it would be safe to move down.
What kind of player do you think is likely to be available to the Oilers at 19, which I think is the LA Kings number now, if all things remain equal? Is there going to be a good player there? Is this a deep enough draft for the Oilers to count on and be getting a player, you know, a Tyler Pitlick type at that number?
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned Pitlick's name, because if the Oilers take Nugent Hopkins first, one of the things that they're going to be looking for later in the first round is probably size. There are two bigger centers in Prince Albert's Mark McNeil, who had a very good playoffs and regular season, and also Barrie's Mark Scheifele, who's about 6'3 and just shy of 180 pounds. A player, though, that I think could be a dark horse is Nicholas Jensen from Oshawa. He's a big kid. He's 6'3", 186. He was just shy of 30 goals and 60 points on the year, but he's got 7 goals in 9 playoff games so far, and I honestly don't see a lot separating Jensen from Landeskog, besides maybe the defensive game. He's a powerful skater, he's got great instincts, and he's given Hamilton all problems long because he's one of the few players that has the size to contend with him physically.
Most NHL teams ask their scouts to have a backup list, a touch list of their favorites from their general area. Do you have somebody who maybe isn't on the NHL draft horizon, for those of us who follow it, who might be a player we should watch out for?
In the first round or later in the
later on
draft? There are a few names that have intrigued me throughout the year watching primarily the WHL. I think one player that hasn't received a lot of respect is Renee Hunter from the Brandon Wheat Kings. He's an excellent defenseman, great skater, maybe a little undersized. But in all the games that I've seen this year of Brandon, he's been used in every single situation. He's a very tough kid, a prototypical two-way player. And there's a chance he doesn't get drafted, but I think that he'll be picked around the 4th or 5th round.
What about goaltenders? Is there any goaltenders in the West that might be worth looking at?
John Gibson from the American under-18 team has been a revelation, I think, all year long. We're going to get a better look at him at the under-18s. He's a big kid at almost 6'3", just a hair shy of 6'3", and 205 pounds. A player that might push for first-round status is Christopher Gibson from Chicoutimi. Again, a bigger kid, which is nice to see in a goaltender. And I think Gibson had a great regular season. I know there was talk that if the season had gone a bit longer, he might have been an MVP candidate. He was so good.
Now, one final question for you, Matt, and this has in regard to Martin Marinson, who started off very well, and people were saying all kinds of great things about him. And then as the season wore on, his team and Marinson himself slowed down. Does that mean the Oilers are more likely, if they choose Nugent Hopkins at one, are they more likely to take a defenseman either with that LA Kings pick or their second first-round pick because Marinson has maybe slid a little?
I have to think that they will be looking for a defenseman with one of the two first-round picks. Of course, a lot will depend on how they go with number one. There are a few good options that will be on the board, but I think Marinson just was a victim of the North American game, just wearing and tearing on his body as the year went on. He's not used to playing that many contests. And as the season progressed, his defensive game just started breaking down. That extra gear wasn't there that he maybe had at the beginning of the year. I remember watching him in a preseason tournament, and he was dominant. He was flying all over the ice. He was making plays in both ends. But that jump was missing later on. And, you know, I wouldn't be disappointed with his year so far, and I don't think it should necessarily impact how the Oilers select later on. But he's certainly a nice piece to have in the pipeline.
Matt, so much. Thanks so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
No problem, Alan.
Okay. That's Matt Bug from McKean's and Dauber Hockey. Interesting insight, and I think reiterating some of the things that we heard in hour number one from Kirk Ludicky from Bruins Draft Watch, especially with the goaltender Gibson, somebody to keep an eye on. And that's basically what we're doing now. The Central Scouting list, the final list is out. We look forward to Bob McKenzie's list and International Scouting Services. But the more information we can find out about these kids, especially now as we follow them maybe through a Memorial Cup or as time goes on. So interesting insight. A few emails to get to here. Let's talk here from Perry. We've got Brent Seabrook doesn't have a no trade on that new contract. What about this? Sam Gagne, Ladislav Smead, and the Oilers' first rounder, the LA pick from the Penner deal for Brent Seabrook. Okay. Brent Seabrook has a will be starting a 5-year, $5.8 million contract. I mean, as an Oiler, you know, follower, I would suggest that, that's a deal that you'd make. I wonder if Chicago would make. I know they have cap problems, mostly because of the Hossa and Campbell contract. So they have 11 players for next year. No, they have 14 players for next year under contract at 51 mil. So, yeah, they got some work to do. That's an interesting insight there from Perry. We'll have to think about. Let me think about that one because that's an interesting one. I didn't say no to it, so that's got to be good sign. Why do scouting reports? This is from Jason. Says, why do scouting reports so often state that a player will not be a big star? Example, Oleksiak won't be as good as Chara when so many stars are drafted late. Example, Chara, 56th overall. I think mostly with regard to, depending upon what you're reading, if you're reading ISS or Bob McKenzie or any of the Red Line or any of those, the idea is to have a take and don't suck, as Jim Rome says. A homogenous scouting report on a player doesn't really, you know, give anybody any excitement about what this player is going to do. So if they say he's not going to be a star, they're just making a call on him. And it's hard to tell, though. I mean, if you're a 17-year-old kid and you're playing and you gain, you know, 25 pounds and 3 inches over the summer, you're a different player when you come back. And that does happen. The ultimate example of that was Dave Taylor, who was drafted in, I think, 75 by Los Angeles. And he was taken deep in the draft. And in one summer, he gained like 25 pounds and 4 inches. And he came back to the college he was playing for. I think it was Clarkson, and had an outstanding year. And from then on, he was an impact power forward, the kind of guy that you saw play for Los Angeles all those years. And it happened in the wink of an eye. He went from the skinny kid who gets sand kicked in his face to Charles Atlas in one summer. And that can happen. So that's what I think. I think scouting reports change, especially. That's why we keep track of them on draft day, because the player will still get better as time goes on. This is Nation Radio on Edmonton Sports Radio, Team 1260. Still lots to come this hour. We'll talk to Greg Drinan from Taking Note. I don't know if you've been following the WHL off-ice stories, but Chilliwack is moving to the island, and the Regina Pats are in the news today. We'll talk about that. Also, Tim Correll from BlackhawkUp.com, and much more coming up.
Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Low Tide. Brought to you by The Pint, Oodle Noodle, and OilersNation.com.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
125 at Nation Radio. Hi, this is Alan Mitchell. And you know what? One of the good things about the playoffs is you get to scoot around the internet looking for good blogs and sites to follow other teams that are in the playoffs. And unfortunately, we've become very used to that as Edmonton Oilers fans. One of the really good sites and interesting sites is run by Cassie McClellan, Associate Managing Editor of RawCharge.com, which is devoted to the Tampa Bay Lightning. Welcome, Cassie.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You know, the first thing I want to talk to you about is Dwayne Roloson. We loved watching him play here in spring 2006 when he was 70. Now he's about 80 years old, and he's doing a great job for you guys, too.
Oh, yeah, definitely. You know, the goaltending is a question for a lot of teams in the NHL. Unless you have a Carey Price or a Martin Brodeur, I mean, everybody is struggling for a good goalie. So Dwayne Roloson in Tampa has just been amazing.
Yzerman was very aggressive and has been very aggressive going out and, you know, getting the deadline deal for Roloson. Tell me a little bit about how this series has gone so far, how you see it going, and the Lightning, I think, would probably be slight underdogs against Pittsburgh, even without Crosby and Malkin, but it looks like this is going to be a long game, possibly a 7-game series.
A lot of people are predicting 6 or 7 games. You know, Tampa Bay is expecting Crosby to come back at some point. Pittsburgh is denying that vehemently. But, you know, coming from Tampa Bay's point of view, you kind of have to play it that way and expect that, you know, the best player in the world will be coming back to play at some point. It's a mental game that the coach is playing with the team, and it's probably one of the better ones, frankly. But a lot of people have been saying it's going to be Tampa's offense versus Pittsburgh's defense. And, yeah, it hasn't really gone that way so far. On Wednesday, Tampa came out pretty flat. They came out hitting, which for them is not necessarily a good thing. They're really more of a finesse team than a physical team. So when they play physically, it kind of really takes away from their offense. And that's that was really shown in game one. And so in game two, they came back and played their game, how they usually play, and it was very successful for them. They came out, you know, passing and shooting, and that really is what they do best.
I was watching the Bolts play the Blues. I think it was Super Bowl Sunday. It was way back anyway. Stamkos scored his 40th goal early in the game, and he hit his head after the goal. It was a real simple play, a real quick play. Happens all the time in hockey. But
right.
He hasn't been as effective after that. Do you know what the – was it a concussion? Why did he score like 5 or 6 goals after that? And really, his season was not good after Super Bowl Sunday.
You know, that's a good question, and a question that Tampa Bay Lightning fans have been asking themselves ever since what happened to Stamkos's offensive production. But, you know, no one's saying anything. No one knows. I don't know if that was a concussion. I don't think it was, but, I mean, it's hard to say. If the player isn't going to talk, then, you know, you just don't know. But, yeah, there's been talk that it might be a lingering injury that came after that. There's also been talk that he is very upset by the fact that he has not been granted a contract extension before. I think he was really, you know, holding on to that, and that didn't happen or hasn't happened. So, I mean, Yzerman is going to sign Stamkos. There's no doubt about that, but I think Stamkos is really hoping that would happen sooner rather than later.
Okay, that's good information. Let's talk draft. In 2008, the Lightning selected Steven Stamkos first overall. The following year, early in the draft, they took Victor Hedman second overall. Is there a sense now, 2 years later, that the Lightning made the right pick in 2009, despite the fact that they ended up passing on Matt Duchene and Evander Kane, who were still available? Is Hedman on track as a lottery high-end pick?
Yes, definitely. I mean, you have to remember, this guy's only 20, and, you know, defense might take a long time to mature in this league, and, I mean, defense is one of the most difficult positions to get down. I used to be a defenseman, actually, when I used to play, so I can kind of relate to what Hedman is doing and where he's coming from, and he's on track. He's going to be a really good defenseman. He's also, you know, not quite finished growing, and that kind of throws off his coordination a bit at times, I think. He's 6'6", so he's also a very lanky guy, and trying to figure out where his place is on the ice, as well as making sure his body is doing what it's supposed to be doing, is probably a bit challenging for him right now. So he's definitely going to be a very good defenseman once he grows into the whole role.
Yeah, it took Chara a while, too. Those big guys, they do take a while. Steve Yzerman has been very aggressive in terms of draft prospects over the last 12 months. The Lightning took Brett Connolly in the first round a year ago, despite some concerns about health, and then dealt their second-round pick from last year, Brock Bukemoom, at the deadline for Eric Brewer. Do you get the sense that Yzerman is focused on winning now or building for the future, or is it just a matter of they caught lightning in a bottle, pardon the pun, and had a nice playoff team?
I think the Yzerman is working for the future, and I think that he was just lucky enough to inherit a team that, you know, was playoff ready to go. The issues in the past couple of years with Tampa Bay has been purely front office issues and coaching issues, not personnel issues.
Okay.
When the new ownership, OK Hockey, had taken over Oren Kulas and Len Barry, they dismantled the team from top to bottom. First thing they did was fire, first thing they did was trade for Mike Smith and Jeff Halpern, and I'm totally blanking on the Finnish player that they picked up, too. And so they fired Tortorella, and from the team Tortorella had coached to the team that Guy Boucher is now coaching, there are only 6 players left.
Okay.
In 3 years.
Yeah, it's been a quick turnaround. Do Lightning fans have a rivalry with Panther fans, or is it a one-sided off the ice as it is on the ice? Has there been enough, I guess, games of import for that rivalry to get going?
No, not really. Neither team has been good at the same time to really, you know, make any game important between the two. It's not at all in any way, shape, or form a rivalry. It's very friendly, actually. We have Rod Charts, the SB Nation blog group, and we have a very happy, friendly relationship with the Panthers blog. In fact, when the Panthers and the Lightning play, we switch blogs for game thread. So we'll have them over for like first period and third period, and over to their site for the second period. You know, so yeah, there's no way, shape, or form that right now the Florida Panthers and the Tampa Bay Lightning have a rivalry.
So there's a barbecue in the middle, sort of thing.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, at this point, yeah. It's all because, you know, the Southeast Division, I know, has long been talked about as being the weakest division in the NHL. And for a long time, that is true. And so you'll find that the Southeast Division teams, the fans have a mentality that it's the division first. You have to win the division in order to make playoffs, because that has been the case for a very long time. Whoever wins the division is the only team from the Southeast Division to make playoffs. And so it's more closed-minded, I guess, more colloquial, more provincial, I guess. I don't know what the right word would be, but and so fans in the Southeast Division really just focus on the Southeast Division because of that.
Okay.
And the Panthers, like I said, when they were good, the Lightning weren't, and when the Lightning were good, the Panthers weren't. And so there's really never been any rivalry in that sense.
Okay. Cassie, thanks so much. I appreciate it, and we'll have you back again. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
That's Cassie McClellan, Associate Managing Editor of RawCharge.com, the Tampa Bay Lightning SBN blog site, and they do good work there. And we thank her for her time. By the way, I keep forgetting to mention, Oklahoma City against Hamilton starts at 2 o'clock today right here on Team 1260. Hamilton is up 1-0 in the series. They had a rather easy time of it against Oklahoma City, who, you know, basically sent down about five or six players from the Oilers. I suspect it'll be a better game today, and it starts in about a half an hour from right now, right here on Team 1260. This is Nation Radio at Edmonton Sports Radio, Team 1260. I believe we have Mr. Tim Correll from BlackHawkUp.com. Tim, are you there?
I am.
I love your site.
Oh, thank you.
I was reading today, and it wasn't you, as Jeffrey Bartle, I believe, is the author. But how's right. This for an opening line? The Blackhawks are doing just enough to piss off everyone. There's hope, then it's ripped away, and with the glimmer flickering, last gasp, it's all over. Vancouver 2, Hawks 0. The way things have gone, I implore you to find a reason it will change on home ice. That's good writing right there.
Jeff is quite the guy, and he's got he doesn't make a big deal out of it, but he's got rather a pedigree behind him as a sports writer, unlike yours truly, who just does this, you know, for the pure notoriety and entertainment value, and, you know, to have people key my car in parking lot.
Well, you shouldn't sell yourself short. You've caused quite a ruckus on the left coast with your inhumane treatment of the Sedins. You're going to be a favorite with Oiler fans. What have you been doing to the poor Sedin twins?
Well, you know, I happen to make mention of contrive a certain nickname for them that didn't go over well on the coast. They're rather fond of their young lads out there, and so they take offense when, you know, people like me in opposing markets tend to liken them to feminine hygiene products. Yep. So that's that didn't go over big, and I'm to be quite frank with us, you know, hold up here in Chicago and doing our thing and not really taking too much notice of what goes on elsewhere, we were rather shocked to find out that it had that news had spread beyond our fan base, and so you can just imagine our surprise as things started to cartwheel out of control on Wednesday.
Well, we'll let people go on your blog site to see what you called them, but it was it definitely caused a ruckus, and I'm glad to see it, because the Canucks do look good, though. I know backs against the wall is old-fashioned. You're never in trouble until you lose a road game or a home game. John Tortorella was all over that last night. Down two games, how do you see this series playing out? The Blackhawks have lost a lot of depth from a year ago, and the Canucks are a hell of a team. Is it going to be a difficult series to go seven games? Or I don't think the Hawks will get swept, but where do you see it going from here?
Well, you know, as I said in my preview yesterday, it's up to the coach to come up with a plan, and it's up to the team to execute the plan. And so far, I really haven't seen either one. It's unfortunate, and maybe things will change around on home ice. However, it's going to have to be a pretty dramatic change. Obviously, this isn't the team from a year ago. Everyone knows that, and everyone can see that it's not a team who falls down 5-0 by the second period and then comes back to win it in overtime 6-5. as we managed to do, I think, in November of 09 or something like that. There just isn't that kind of drive and confidence, I guess it is. And, is it going seven games? No. Will we get swept? Probably not. But, my original prediction of Hawks in five obviously is out the window. And unless I see something dramatically different in game three, I think it's probably the Canucks in five.
Which of those great Hawks players from last year, like, Ladd and Byfuglien, which one do you really think the team misses the most?
Hindsight's always 20/20 in a circumstance like this, but it's easy to see the kind of impact that Andrew Ladd had when he kind of got his the space opened up for him in Atlanta. There was never going to be enough room for Andrew Ladd to be that kind of player in Chicago. The role of captain was filled. The role of the top six players, really, that was set. And he would occasionally crack that lineup, but not very often. And he certainly didn't have the kind of freedom from the coaches within the system that they were playing to be the guy that he has been for the Atlanta Thrashers. And so, on the one hand, we miss him like crazy because he's a huge physical presence, a quick guy with great hands in front of the net, causes a lot of trouble in the offensive zone. But on the other hand, you really love to see him be able to come into his own like that after so many years in the league and a great year with a couple of great years in Chicago, and then go down to Atlanta and do as well as he's done. You know, you really feel happy for the guy, and you're glad that he's going to be able to make a solid impact down there. I think that everyone here has been kind of saying, oh, why we miss Buff so much. I tend not to agree with that too much. It's difficult to argue with the fact that it's, somebody who more closely resembles a backhoe than he does an NHL winger is a difficult commodity to replicate. But he wasn't happy at playing forward. He was extraordinarily productive playing forward, but he wasn't happy there. And as we saw when he went back to Atlanta, he switched to defense. Not that it hurt his offensive product at all either. I think he's, close to 30 goals again this year, isn't he?
Yeah, great season.
So, I think between those two guys, the one that really would have made a big difference having the Werke to have stayed with the Blackhawks would have been Andrew Ladd.
How much cap trouble are the Hawks in? Is it better this year than next year cap-wise?
Next year's actually, we've got a lot more ability to move around. Seabrook was the big question mark. Now that question has been answered. Fortunately, he's staying put. We're in more or less of the same circumstance that we were last year going into the following season, where, the guys, the $3+ million men, the Boland, Sharp, Hossa, Taves, Kane, and on the defensive zone, and you've got Jalmerson, Seabrook, Keith, and Campbell. Those roles are all taken care of, and those guys are locked in. It's the, what are you going to do on the million a year on down? Because, guys like Kopechki and Brower and, some of the new acquisitions like Michael Frolik, and also you've got the lower end of the spectrum with Jake Bowell and Fernando Pisani and Ryan Johnson. Do you re-sign those guys at that level and hold on to them, or are there better assets at the same money available in the free agent market? Do you just let them walk? There's going to be a lot of juggling in that bottom six forwards going forward. I think that the defense is – I think we're going to see Nick Leddy as a lock to make next year. He's in at $1.11 million for the next three. He's on an entry-level contract. The kid is showing some serious potential. Obviously, he's got some holes in his game, and he needs to step it up a little bit in a couple of areas. His going on safari below the hash marks in the attacking zone is something I really can't get on board with, especially when we end up with him, standing, looking around in the stands, wondering what's going on as the puck sails past behind Crawford into the goal.
Rookie defenseman.
Yes, and, that was something interesting that I found as I was looking through the draft history with the Hawks was the fact that these guys that are coming up, you take a look at where they came from, when we drafted them, and then the difference between when we drafted them and when their first year in the league was.
Yeah.
And when you look at someone like a Kane or Taves, Kane jumped, obviously, and he went from draft to starting lineup. Taves took a year But then you get guys like Nicholas Hjalmarsson, 4 years.
Yep.
You've got Dustin Byfuglien, 4 years.
Yep.
Brent Seabrook, 2 years. Duncan Keith, 3 years. They just take more time to develop a defenseman, and those are the guys that are the serious talents.
Yep.
You know, the wild card in there was Dustin Byfuglien, who was drafted 8th round overall.
Yeah.
And, you know, anyone who follows the draft as closely as many of the folks in your audience do know that, you know, beyond rounds 1 and 2, anything you get after that is just gravy, especially as you get down into the, you know, 7th round, 8th round, 9th round that we had a few years back. But the defensemen tend to take longer to mature. And so Letty is still an extraordinarily young kid. He's got a lot of talent. He's got a lot of upside. But we just need to be patient with the fact that he is going to probably take those full 3 years to get to the point where we're all saying, yeah, the kid's a career player. We're going to make sure that he stays here for a while.
Tim, thanks so much. Appreciate your time.
Hey, it's not a problem.
Okay. That's Tim Correll from BlackhawkUp.com. Great site. And you know what he just talked about? That's a very interesting insight. That's what the Oilers are dealing in. Do you wait for Larson, or do you hope that Petrie and Plante and Tubert and all of those guys can deliver in a couple of years? Because it takes a long time for defensemen to develop, and, you know, it could be Larson's 21 or 22-year-old year before he can really help the Edmonton Oilers. Coming up, Greg Brennan from Taking Note.
This is Nation Radio with Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Low Tide. Brought to you by The Pint, Oodle Noodle, and OilersNation.com.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
Far be it for me to tell you to turn your radio off. You should leave it on. But if you're not watching the Detroit Phoenix game right now, it's 4-3 with about 35 seconds, 40 seconds left on the game?
Yeah,
something like that.
That.
And it is really outstanding. The last 5 minutes or so have been great, and a great comeback for Phoenix no matter what happens. This is Nation Radio, and I'm Alan Mitchell. We're joined by Greg Drinan from Taking Note. Greg, how are you, man?
I'm great, Alan. How are you?
Good. You know, speaking of Phoenix / Winnipeg, I check your site every day, and today I knew a little bit about the because you've been updating me a little bit about the Chilliwack team heading to the coast or heading to the island, but now we're talking about the Pats being involved. Tell me what's going on here.
Well, the Regina Pats and their landlord, used to be Regina Exhibition Park, it's now called the Evraz Place, have long had a contentious relationship when it comes to lease negotiations. They're in negotiations again. I was told yesterday that the Evraz Place gave the Pats a take-it-or-leave-it offer, and furthermore, I was told that the Pats, Russ Parker out of Calgary, the owner, is seriously thinking about leaving it. Now, these are negotiations, so, you know, I'm sure that there's a lot of things being said, and maybe someone's bluff is going to be called. But in the past, when these negotiations have gotten a little frosty and a little, there's never been the Pats haven't had an option like they do now, where they can say, well, we don't like your offer, we're going to go to Chilliwack. Chilliwack is losing the Bruins to Victoria. There's an arena in Chilliwack that definitely meets WHL standards. So, I'm sure the Pats are going to try to use that to their benefit. Whether they'll go all the way and end up in Chilliwack, I would find that hard to believe, but it at this point in time, it certainly is an option.
This is the team of Terry Harper and Bill Hickey and all of those guys. This is an old-time WHL franchise. When was the last WHL franchise with that kind of history to move?
Well, there hasn't been one. The Pats came awfully close in the mid-'80s when I was at the Leader Post in Regina at the time, and they were actually a deal had been made to sell them to Swift Current. There was a huge dispute in Regina at the time because, believe it or not, the Regina Exhibition Park wanted to or was in the process of implementing a $1 parking fee. Parking up until that time had been free, and they decided they were going to charge people $1 to park. And I remember the foo-for-ah at the time. And lo and behold, John Rittinger, who an accountant in Swift Current, who'd been long trying to get a WHL team for Swift Current, swooped in, cut a deal to buy the Pats from who at the time were owned by the Pinder family from Saskatoon.
Yeah.
Herb Pinder Jr. was the you know, the family front man, if you will. I still couldn't remember the sign on what was then the Agrodome, what's now the Brandt Center, the arena the Pats play in, that it was during the Christmas break, and I believe it was the Pats' first game coming out of the Christmas break. Might have been scheduled for Boxing Day. Anyway, the game was canceled, according to the marquee, because the team was moving to Swift Current. So, you know, you're right about the Pats. They are the oldest, I believe, the oldest junior hockey team to be continuously in operation in Canada. So there's a huge amount of history there.
You know, it's funny because you say all that, and the memories are flooding back, because I worked at CKCK in the same building, 1922 right. Park Street, same time.
Yep.
time flies.
And there's an Edmonton angle there, too, because the Pats... general manager and head coach at the time was Billy Moores, who had left the University of Alberta to coach the Pats. He left at Regina. He only lasted the one season. He'd had enough. He as much as he enjoyed coaching, I don't think he liked the wheeling and dealing in junior hockey. I think he found that a big adjustment coming back from university. And of course, he went on to join the Oilers.
And is there a possibility that Winnipeg would have to move the Moose out, and is Regina a possibility there too?
Well, all of this, of course, hinges on the Phoenix Coyotes, who, by the way, just finished losing to the Red Wings 4-3.
Yeah.
If the Coyotes move back to Winnipeg, and there's so much smoke coming out of there now that I think it's far more likely than it's ever been. Well, then the AHL's Manitoba Moose are going to have to go somewhere. I mean, I've heard a number of options. I've heard a swap with Saskatoon, where the Saskatoon Blades would move to Winnipeg and the Moose would move to Saskatoon. But then yesterday I heard that the Everest Place people in Regina have had discussions, awfully preliminary discussions, of course, with the American Hockey League about possibly getting the Moose.
Greg,
the one thing that spurred a lot of this was...
Greg, we got to run, buddy. Sorry.
Okay, no problem.
Okay. This is Nation Radio. We're out. AHL action just around the corner. Have a great day, everybody.